my friend Dr. Jeff Repeta is joining me on the other end of the line. Doc, how you been? Well?
Good morning. My life is good.
That's what I like to hear. But unfortunately, today, the reason why I've asked you is because I am so bothered by what I have read. I read this originally last week, and I'm sorry it's taken me so long to get you on the air, when the Centers for Disease Control says opioid deaths are up. Depending on whose number and what categories you look at, opioids, heroin, things like that, anywhere between 7 and 9.5%. 200 people a day die from overdoses. That does not surprise you, and I'm horrified by that, but it's because you've been dealing with this, and you deal with this every single day. You and your partner are one of the two rarities that are specially certified for this kind of treatment. Am I right?
Yeah, to give people my background, I'm a family practice doctor, so I do a little bit of everything. You know, I see people with high blood pressure, diabetes. I see kids for their well-child checks. But in 2011, I got a special certification from the DEA that allowed me to prescribe a medication called buprenorphine, which is the single most effective treatment, intervention, whatever you want to call it, that there is for getting people who are addicted to opiates off of opiates. So in the past 7 years over in Murfreesboro, where I am, I've treated somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 people for this problem. Now, I don't want to toot my own horn too much and make it sound like I've treated them all successfully, because that would be disingenuous and just flat wrong. But I currently have about 175 people on my program and doing pretty well.
I'm kind of curious about something, Doc, because, let's face it, man, I didn't fall off the cabbage truck yesterday. I'm familiar with this. I've lost friends through addiction. Some of them are in jail, and I'll probably never see them again as a result of meth. I've had people who accidentally died because friends of mine, because of the activities they were undertaking while they were on drugs. I've seen people's lives ruined, their finances ruined, their children's lives ruined because of drugs. Now, And it's not like I've never had a problem saying no to something myself. I mean, so I don't want to look like we're passing judgment. And I think the fact that when you look at this and you start looking at this numerically, that you should be concerned, because this is really, if you're just a numbers guy, 72,287 deaths from drug overdoses last year, 49,060 from opiates. While I'm on this subject, Doc, what pills are we talking about that people take too many of and die? I mean, Vicodin. Well, the Prince lawsuit this family this week. His family sued the doctors that prescribed him the medicine, but the medicine he actually died was fake Vicodin with fentanyl in it. But what are the names that we're talking about?
Yeah, so I think to understand this, let me go back and give a little bit of history and a little bit of perspective, I guess, on trends in drug use in the United States over the past 20 years or so, which is just a depressing topic, but it is what it is. Opiate use in the United States really kind of kicked up around the year 2000, and most people point to the year 2003 as kind of the start of the opiate epidemic, so to speak, is when we really started seeing doctors were prescribing a lot more medications under pressure from the pharmaceutical industry, under pressure from our own internal regulators saying, hey, we're not doing a very good job of treating pain. So the number of opiates that doctors were prescribing was going up quite a bit and peaked in terms of the number of opiate pills. And when I say opiate pills, talking primarily hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, and fentanyl comes in the form of a patch. So those were kind of the big ones. And use of those spiked and peaked somewhere in the neighborhood of 2011, 2012, and slowly started to trend down a little bit from there, because physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs started to recognize that, hey, there's a problem here. We need to do something about this. Unfortunately, what had happened, though, was that because of overprescribing, we had created this epidemic of addiction. We're dumping more opiates just out into America in general. More people are getting hooked on these things. And when doctors started to become privy to this and to say, wait a minute, hold on, I need to prescribe less of this, people turned elsewhere. So somebody who was already addicted to pills, all of a sudden their doctor comes to realize, hey, this person has a problem, I'm cutting them off. So they have a harder time getting a hold of oxycodone, hydrocodone. So what happens is we started to see an uptick in heroin use, and we started to see an uptick in a synthetic opiate called fentanyl, which seems to be coming primarily from China into the U.S. And the problem with that is those two things are much more potent, and it's a whole lot more likely that people will overdose on those things. So even though it looks like the trend of opiate use is still going down a little bit, so it seems like there are fewer people using opiates. We're not making leaps and bounds there, but the numbers are going down some. But still, the number of deaths keeps going up because the opiates people are using are more potent and more likely to cause overdose.
You know, I've got an interesting that I think dovetails into this is new report that had just been issued here in the last couple of days about Xanax use in teens. You and I both know that being a teenager or even younger is more anxiety-ridden than ever. Social media, peer pressure, all these things that go in. And so there's a new theory here that when we take teens and this theoretically safer drug Xanax and give that to them for anxiety, and then when they grow up, they are predisposed towards this pill will make me better, make me feel better. That we're actually creating this because we're grooming them, for lack of a better word, at a young age with other drugs, and so, and then there's a progression.
Yeah, so it really looks like giving any teenager, even early 20s aged person, kind of psychotropic medications does not do good things to the developing brain, and it can create this dependence on those things. I personally see very limited use for Xanax or its kind of cousin drug, Ativan, at this point. There was a massive study that came out a couple of years ago that said that, okay, they're generally prescribed for anxiety. If you take them every day, do they work for anxiety? Yes, but only for a few months. And after that, the body gets used to having them in, gets what we call dependent, which means it just kind of stops working. But then you got this flip side where it's hard to get off of. Even somebody who takes Xanax exactly like they should, if they want to stop it, the problem is, one, it's stopped treating their anxiety, so it no longer works. But then, two, trying to come down off of it actually can make anxiety worse, can cause insomnia, can cause seizures, can cause the person to feel like there are bugs crawling off their skin, and it's very, very, very uncomfortable. So a lot of people kind of get stuck on it. And then we find out there's long-term consequences of being on Xanax for years and years and years and years, the biggest of which is early-onset Alzheimer's disease. So people who take Xanax, Ativan, or their relative drugs, Valium, clonazepam, every day for years and years, have a much higher chance of getting Alzheimer's disease and a much higher chance of getting it at a younger age than the general population.
Right. Well, you just scared the hell out of me, so thanks. So let's take a look at this.
Good. It really, you know, the hard part about those drugs is if somebody comes in and they're having panic attacks, and panic attacks are terrible. You feel like you're going to die if you're in the middle of one. So people come in and they want immediate relief, and a lot of times they're very short-sighted. You know, they want to feel good right now, darn it, and whatever happens 10 years down the road, they'll deal with it then. And I get that. It just stinks to have panic attacks. It's no good. It stinks to be anxious. Anybody out there who suffers with anxiety knows what a miserable experience is, and it can be a little bit rough sometimes for a healthcare provider to look that person in the eye and be like, yep, I could give you this medication and it's going to make you feel a whole lot better for the next week.
Right.
But in the long term, it does you more harm than good. So no, I'm not going to prescribe that to you. But that's really, you know, we healthcare providers kind of need to put on our big boy pants and do that in general, realizing that they're more trouble than they're worth in the long run, these medications.
My doctor in Carbondale, who I just mentioned to you before we went on the air, just retired this week. He had that conversation with me. Right. Cause anxiety attacks. Yeah. Well, on Sunday afternoon, about 3:30, I'm going to get him about worried about who's on this week and whether I can carry the water. Right. I mean, I literally get that way, but you know, and here's the thing, Doc, you know, since we're talking about it, unless we're being honest, it really doesn't matter. You know, as I realize now, as I look back on my life at my age, I thought I was out having fun, when largely it looks like, if I'm really honest with myself, that I was self-medicating most of my life, and still do, because we self-medicate with everything from a Twinkie to Xanax to heroin, or just a plain old cocktail at the end of the work until we can't stop. So I want to take a quick look at this because there's something else I want to hit on. Synthetic opiates in the newest count for the Centers for Disease Control, 29,418. All right, we talked about that fentanyl, things like that. Now, when it gets to heroin, that's responsible for 15,950 deaths. Natural opiates, 14,951. Here's the interesting thing. The deaths from cocaine overdoses, right, jumped up. And we don't normally see these stimulants jump up, but they did. And stimulants including meth overdoses, 10,708. Methadone used to treat heroin addiction, 3,287. So that's largely the breakout. And we said opiates are 49,060. When it comes to this. So 200 a day, every 8 minutes someone dies. Cocaine is going up in the issue as well. Now, the governor this week signed a piece of legislation allowing medical marijuana as a surrogate for painkillers in an attempt to address this issue. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I have really mixed feelings about that for two reasons. One, here's the good part. In states that have decriminalized marijuana, it's been shown that opiate overdose deaths drop. And it seems like there's a pretty clear relationship that if you open up access to marijuana, that the number of people who are taking opiates will go down. In other words, people are likely to substitute marijuana for opiates. And nobody overdoses and dies on marijuana. There's some other societal cost to being on marijuana, which is a kind of a whole different topic. But so that's the good news. It looks like by opening up access to marijuana, you do decrease the number of opiate overdose deaths. So that's a pretty clear trend. So that's the good part of the legislation. Here's the part that makes me a little bit itchy, though, is that the research for medical marijuana, not just for pain, but really for anything, is really pretty lacking, meaning that just I think the enthusiasm for medical marijuana is far outpacing the science at this part. Mm. The way marijuana was approved as a treatment for medical conditions is just entirely out of sorts with the way typically the way treatments are approved. Usually the way a medication has to be approved is some company or somebody has to do a study, and not just one study, but typically three fairly large studies. Usually it's one in animals and then two in humans that show that the medication is safe and effective so that it works. And there are a lot of medications that get studied that get shown that they don't work and they never make it to market. So when a drug company goes to researching a medication, the odds of any one particular medication making the market is actually pretty slim. Yeah. In marijuana, we've kind of turned that on its head and said, we don't have any good research. Let's just go ahead and we'll say that it's used to treat these things and we'll sort all that stuff out later. So as a surrogate for opiates for treatment of pain, my only sort of concern or pause there, I guess, is that, you know, the little bit of research that we have on medical marijuana shows that it's not really good for pain. You might get some people to tell you differently, but that's just not what the science says at this point. It's the science is a little bit conflicting, but by and large, it looks like at very, very, very small doses, cannabinoids, which is the chemical in marijuana, maybe helps with pain a little bit. That at slightly larger doses, it doesn't do much at all. And that at big doses, it actually makes pain worse. So it's a little bit strange. Most pain medications, the more you give somebody, the better it treats pain. But with marijuana, the little bit of limited research we have right now actually shows the opposite.
Well, but you know, but see, and I'm one of those THC guys. What about tetrahydrocannabinol? Because, you know, because it is, you can smoke your brains out, right? And you just end up staring at the TV, right? You know, because your take on this is, it's interesting because I was thinking, and I was watching as this legislation is signed, and inside my head, the voice said, hey, if you give me marijuana, I won't do harder drugs. Because what I heard, and I know you do this, because every addict wants to negotiate with a doctor about pills. So I know you've been something through similar like that, right?
Absolutely. People all the time, well, the most common story I get is somebody will tell me how their anxiety is just god-awful, or their pain is just god-awful, and the only thing that works for them is marijuana to improve their pain, to improve their anxiety. So they're trying to justify, you know, daily use of it to me. But then very quickly, it's followed by how debilitating their symptoms are and by how they just aren't really functioning in life because their anxiety or their pain is so bad. I have had, and I'm not exaggerating this number at all, it's an exact number, I have had one patient ever who came into me and said, you know, as long as I smoke marijuana, I function. And this person worked, held a job, got through daily life perfectly fine. Every other person wants to tell me how well marijuana works, but then their life's kind of a mess. They're not really holding a job. They're still having debilitating anxiety and depression symptoms. So when you look at their lives objectively, again, I've seen exactly one person who I think maybe it actually worked for. Everybody else wants to tell me it works, but then all the evidence points otherwise.
Right. That's interesting. Really is. Okay. Here's the question du jour, the hardest, meanest question ever. How do you stop it?
Yeah, how do you, well, which part? Opiate overdoses, you think?
It's a hairball. That's what makes it a queen question. Overdoses, 72,287. It grows every year. You're working on treatment programs. How do we break the back of this?
Yeah, there's no simple answer, I guess, is the short thing. I see several different pieces that kind of need to fall together. Law enforcement ramped up to limit access to the drugs because it has been shown that that is an effective mechanism for lowering the number of overdoses. So I think that needs to happen. Two, more treatment for people who are already addicted. And the state is kind of working on that. Still the most effective thing is just we need more doctors to prescribe buprenorphine like I do. And it's not like what I do is a miracle by any stretch of the imagination. It just so happens that that little molecule in that medication works better than anything else. So more law enforcement, better treatments. And I think that the court system needs to take a little better approach to catching people with addiction issues also. Every so often, you know, it's kind of election season. I still see politicians out there who are pushing this idea of we're hard on crime, we're harder on criminals, we're going to increase punishments for this. I don't know how many times that idea has to be proven to be ineffective at deterring crime or at deterring addiction before somebody is willing to say, hey, stiffening penalties does not work. It just creates a higher prison population that doesn't deter people from doing this. So I think the court system needs to gear itself a little bit more towards rehabilitation and a little bit less towards
incarceration. Yeah. It is one of the more difficult subjects. And then the psychology of the human being who says, yeah, I take 60 a day, I'm fine. While they're literally, their organs are shutting down and they keep doing it because they're sick and they have to have the pills and they are basically killing themselves and they know it. But the drugs make you feel pretty good about what you're doing. The human brain is, you know, we don't want anything to be wrong with us. I'm fine. Denial is an incredible craft when it's employed correctly. And for you, those are barriers to proper treatment as well.